Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to the Autosport Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas. Formula One's 2020 Turkish Grand Prix took place today at Istanbul Park, with Lewis Hamilton winning for the 10th time in 2020 for Mercedes, and in doing so clinching this year's world title, his 7th, which equals Michael Schumacher's record haul. But that actually massively understates today's race, which was a wet weather thriller, featuring many slips and spins, crashes, including two before the race, bold passes and botched pit stops, a new long-time race leader, and ultimately Mercedes winning on a day where it had arrived on the back foot after struggling in practice and qualifying. Lance Stroll led the majority of the race, getting away well from pole in front of his Racing Point teammate Sergio Perez, while Max Verstappen and Alex Albon had torrid getaways as they struggled from second and fourth on the grid. The Renault and Mercedes cars surged forward behind the leading pink machines, with all four essentially getting together at the first corner, although only two made contact. And that was the Renault pair after Daniel Ricciardo had to avoid Hamilton sealing to the inside and tagging Esteban Ocon as he turned away as a result. Valtteri Bottas had to avoid the spinning Ocon on the outside, and he went around as well, falling to the back of the field. The pair then had further contact further around lap 1 when Bottas misjudged his braking for turn 9 and hit Ocon, picking up damage to his front wing and steering and giving Ocon a puncture. Up front, Stroll and Perez led the way, chased by Sebastian Vettel, who had made a brilliant start from 11th on the grid for Ferrari. His teammate Charles Leclerc triggered the change from wets to winters from further back in the pack, after which Verstappen was able to jump Vettel by staying out a few laps longer before taking the inters. Hamilton was doing something of a watching brief at this stage regarding the five cars ahead of him, as Albon then came by Hamilton and Vettel during the laps after the stops. At this phase of the race, Red Bull was on top, before Verstappen spun at high speed just past the turn 11 kink, flat spotting his tyres and having to take an extra stop as a result after he'd had a go at passing Perez. Albon then closed in on Perez too, who was slowly eroding the big lead Stroll had enjoyed after the stops. But Albon faded back as the inter started to wear, at which point Vettel and Hamilton really came alive. Ferrari opted to pit Vettel again after Leclerc had shown great pace and made progress from being 14th at the end of lap 1 with his second set of inters, but Hamilton stayed out as he enjoyed the tyre temperature advantage he had on his ageing set. With that came grip and pace. Albon spun out of his way shortly afterwards before Hamilton arrived at the back of the Racing Point pair a few laps past half distance. Stroll was brought in for fresh inters on lap 36 of 58, which proved to be something of a mistake as he encountered severe graining in the subsequent laps, fading to 9th at the finish. While up front, Hamilton chased down and passed Perez with a simple DRS pass on the main straight. Hamilton had demanded to be left out on his first set of inters, actually a used set from Saturday that had done three laps coming into the race and would last for 53 in total, and he was untroubled from there, actually lapping Bottas, who spun four more times after his two on lap one for a total of six for the day. And Hamilton went on his way to take a commanding win ahead of Perez, audibly and visibly emotional after the race as he considered the magnitude of his achievement. Perez, suddenly struggling on his own ancient inters late on, only finished second after Leclerc slid off the road three turns from home as the young Ferrari star had shone on his third stint to rise ahead of Albon and Vettel and looked best placed to capitalise when Perez went deep at turn 9 on the final lap and lost momentum. But a lock-up at the turn 12 overtaking spot cost Leclerc dear as Perez, who had closed back in on the Ferrari despite it having DRS after his own late off, snuck back through when Leclerc went deep, followed by Vettel, who came home to take his first podium of 2020 in third. So, after all of that very long interruption, which I can see them all yawning as I turn my Zoom camera back on tonight to discuss all of that on this podcast, are motorsport.com's F1 editor Jonathan Noble, Autosport's F1 reporter Luke Smith, and GP Racing executive editor Stuart Codling. And Codders, I'm going to start with you. I figured I'd throw you hopefully a difficult question. I don't know, maybe it's very easy and you can bat it away, you know, we'll see how we get on. But where does that victory, do you think, rank amongst Lewis Hamilton's best wet weather wins? And the reason why I'm asking you that is because it was really interesting at one point in the press conference, he mentioned the fact that he was aware that he has something of an excellent reputation in the wet. And given Mercedes struggles on the rest of the weekend, I think he was like, oh, is this one where I'm not going to do very well in the wet? But that was because that was basically a wet weather win like no other because of the state of the new asphalt with very low grip. So yes, back to my original question, which as ever I've talked and witted on too long from. Where does that rank in Hamilton's wet weather drives to you?
ranks pretty high up, actually. I mean, you're probably thinking of Silverstone 2008, aren't you, whenever you think of a Lewis Hamilton wet weather masterclass. And I was minded of that race quite a lot this afternoon, not just through Lewis's performance, but also through the performance of Valtteri Bottas, which put me in mind of Felipe Massa in Silverstone 2008, had more spins than Pete Burns. So, I thought it was exquisitely judged victory, really. He was someone who, you kind of thought it was all over for Lewis right from the start, where he was struggling, but he played himself back into it. He was patient when other people were losing their heads.
He certainly was. And I very much agree with you there on the sort of 2008 callback, because of, first of all, it was a wet weather race there as well, but also because of all those spins for Massa and Bottas today. But also, this race in Turkey today reminded us of another race from Hamilton's past where he came off really badly. It's China in 2007, where his aging wet weather tyres, they went down to the canvas, he came into the pit, slid up, doesn't lose it on the day, but does end up losing the 2007 world title there. And he talked a lot about how he had learnt from that mistake and what had gone wrong. John, where do you think he demonstrated the lessons that he learned 13 years ago as a rookie to win this race today?
Two factors and two lessons from previous races that helped. One was obviously China 2007. When they'd gone far too long on worn tyres, got too cautious and nervous on strategy, changed tyres, came into the Shanghai pit lane and basically pretty much failed to turn left because there was no grip left, and ended up in the gravel, which effectively cost him that 2007 title. So that was weighing on his mind in the final stages when he was a pit stop clear of Perez. The threat of rain was coming, and the tactic that helped him and Perez stay in front, which was basically extend the stint on the inters, so they were in effect slick, would have fallen apart. If it rained in the final two or three laps, they would have been the worst tyre to be on. So the race was still hanging in the balance at that phase, but that rain never came. But that was that factor there. And I think the other factor was going back to Silverstone 08, and one of the lessons there was about when, as track conditions vary, sometimes an old inter can be better than a new inter. Even though the track looks like it is perfect for inters, there is a difference between a worn inter that has the characteristics of a slick and a new inter, which can sometimes not be ideal. It can grain too quickly, as Lance Stroll found out to his cost. So they were kind of those two lessons of Silverstone 2008, with the difference between a worn inter and a new inter and what you need to do and not do in those circumstances, and China 07 with when it wears out, it is finished.
I have quite an amusing China 2007 story, if you can spare 2 minutes.
I mean, I don't believe any of your stories are ever amusing, Godders, but you can give it a good go.
Is this a China story in your hands, Godders?
It's not a Carol Black and Decker one. Very, very briefly, obviously, in the run-up to China 2007, it was anticipated that Lewis would win the championship at that race, because he was a shoo-in, and as John has just mentioned, McLaren screwed the race for him by keeping him out too long because they wanted him to finish ahead of Fernando Alonso, who they hated, on the track. So they completely screwed their race and their championship in a vain attempt to screw over the driver they didn't like. But the terrestrial broadcasters and the non-terrestrial broadcasters basically had Sunday mapped out that this would be a Lewis Hamilton champion celebration. So BBC News 24, it was then known, had various researchers phoning me every 2 minutes and not taking no for an answer, wanting me to appear on their show at 9 o'clock in the morning or something, which involved them sending a Mercedes taxi all the way from Television Centre, as it was then, to Farnham, where I continue to live, to pick me up in my suit and send me up to appear on TV for all of 2 minutes. As I walked into TV Centre, John Watson was just coming out. So there was nothing else left to talk about but Lewis Hamilton. And as it happened, we were all analysing his failure to win the world championship rather than talking about this amazingly successful maiden world championship for a rookie in his first season of Formula One.
I like how at one stage you thought that was going to be a short anecdote, but still, nevertheless, an interesting story.
It's quite funny. It's amazing how much money the BBC used to be prepared to blow on taxes, sending a Mercedes 35 miles or so each way just to have some idiot gibber on TV for all of a minute and a half. Actually, that anecdote went on longer than my screen time on BBC News 24.
Well, if you let me return to the role of gibbering idiot on this podcast, Goddess, I'm more than happy to do so.
Happily.
Thank you very much. Yes, and it's a role I no doubt always aspire to and will always be able to handle. Luke, it's interesting to consider Hamilton today versus China 2007, because he was sort of saying afterwards, back at that race, I didn't have the confidence, I didn't have the knowledge to back myself, to overrule the team. Because we hear quite a lot of Hamilton making suggestions, making demands of his team, and it must still be quite hard to strike that balance between trusting those guys who have all the information, they can see a lot more than what the driver can behind the wheel, and knowing in those conditions this is what's right, even though he can't predict the future and what's going to happen. So how impressed were you by what he did today in terms of the decisions that he took?
Oh, massively. I mean, he is a driver who, even after what is his 14th season in Formula One, and the knowledge bank he's built up is something that he just continues to deploy brilliantly. And I think that's something that today, in this such a difficult weekend, I mean, Hamilton said after Friday's running that he could do no setup work with the car because he was just focusing on the tyres. And then after Saturday, he said after qualifying, he just didn't know what to expect. And he said, like, no one knows what the right strategy is going to be or how to play it. So it's very much a race that you kind of just manage as you go. And we heard him come on the radio at one point and say, how long are these intermediates meant to last? And the team was like, we can't tell you, we don't know that. So it was very much sort of a step into the unknown for all of them. But he just continued to sort of eke out the stint and manage. And as we sort of got to that crossover point where we did see some of the drivers, such as Lance Stroll, such as the Ferraris, pit for a second set of intermediates, Hamilton made clear that he didn't want to come in, that he was fine to keep going. And then we got towards the closing stage and he was like, I just want to make sure these tyres aren't going to blow up or anything. And by then Mercedes had the knowledge they built up from Bottas's stint. Obviously he pitted for a second time so they could look at his inters. And they said, nope, similar condition, so you should be fine to get to the end. And it's just that, it's that maturity and it's that experience that I think you can only get when you get to that far in your career, basically. But it's also, Lewis is someone who keeps saying, like, if you ask him to recall like an old race or anything like that, he's always like, oh, I've got a terrible memory, like I really don't remember things and whatever. Actually, he's got a very, very good memory, like, and the things that he needs to remember and the things that do decide championships, such as China 07, he has that very much ingrained on his mind. And the heartbreak that he had in 2007, that's something that still carries with him, but he's turned it into a positive. And we saw that perfectly today, that it's very similar conditions where you're wearing that tyre down and it's going to sort of becoming a slick. And if you go too far, as they did in 07, back then he could never have overruled the team because he was a rookie, he didn't have the experience. But today he had that knowledge that he could easily just say, look, let's keep going. But also it's the trust that the team has in him as well, and that is such an important two-way street, and I think perfectly between the driver and the team.
Absolutely. I thought there was another thing Hamilton said in his press conference, which was interesting. It was a two-part press conference. They had Sergio Perez and Sebastian Vettel appear before Hamilton did, presumably because he was still away with the TV cameras, but there we go. It's something that he said that was actually quite evocative, that he was sort of looking in his rearview mirrors at his tyres, trying almost to see that tyre from 2007 at China, and the feeling and the sensation of, like, is it going to happen again? But he said he just couldn't. Obviously, that, you know, he couldn't quite tell how it was going, but obviously he felt that he still had enough. And critically, the aging intermediates kept that tyre temperature. John, I just want to go back to sort of the start of the race, or even actually further back, looking at qualifying and practice. How on the back foot, how much in trouble do you think Mercedes was? Because it really hadn't shown anything by that stage, despite the fact it clearly has the best car in the field. And the teams, some of the other teams, we spoke about this, Luke and I did on the podcast yesterday, Dave Robson saying that it's not all about downforce, because if it was, Mercedes still would have been fastest. There was something the other teams were doing that were helping with tyre warm-up and building that critical tyre temperature. So how in trouble do you think they were?
I think what we saw today was kind of a step on from what we had in Portimao. If you rewind back to the first laps at Portimao, for example, the two guys who made the rapid progress early on, Carlos Sainz and Kimi Raikkonen, basically aggressively switched on their tyres, got the heat into them in the tricky conditions and disappeared, basically. Then it took time for the tyres of the Mercedes to come in. You know, Bottas got his up first, then Lewis was after. But then as that race developed, Lewis charged through. And I think that's the same when you dig through the entire weekend. I think we see a similar picture that the problem with Mercedes was they just couldn't get the temperature into the tyres in qualifying, couldn't switch the tyre on, whereas the Racing Point clearly could switch that tyre on immediately. And we saw that in the first phase of the race. I mean, it looked like Racing Point were gone. Lance Stroll had disappeared up front. Sergio was falling back from Lance. But they were gone. Any normal race, when you're 15 seconds clear of the opposition after a handful of laps, that's the Grand Prix done and dusted. But I think the Mercedes problem was switching the tyre on, and that gentle way of building the tyre temperature up actually proved to be the way to win the race. I think you spoke to Dave Robson on Saturday night, and he talked about a tortoise and hare race. Basically, the hare would be lighting up the tyres early on and disappearing up the road, and then the tortoise would slowly get there and actually being able to manage that tyre pace, looking after it better, was what we saw from Mercedes. And also partly in that Lance Stroll and Perez battle too. Lance was obviously super aggressive on the tyres, which was brilliant for qualifying, brilliant for the first lap of the race. Sergio, more considered, more calm, which, you know, fell back a bit, then it allowed him to manage the tyres, just as Lewis did. So I think it was a tale of, you know, the pace was there in the car and the pace was there in the tyres, but the characteristic of where that pace peaked was very, very different across the field.
Yeah, Andreas Seidel was quite interesting on that point in the McLaren post-race press conference, where he talked about striking that balance between qualifying and the race. You know, sometimes you see a disparity in performance of the cars between Saturday and Sunday. But also he talked of, I actually wrote down his words, he talked about introducing the tyres, and he said that, you know, what one of the reasons for McLaren's kind of apparent surge in pace towards the end of the race was when they put on their final set of intermediates, they'd kind of got an idea of how to introduce them, as it were, and to not to be too aggressive on them and not to damage them, particularly through turn eight, when you'd first put them on. And I was wondering if, on the one hand, Lance had been a bit too aggressive and that is why his tyres were graining. Maybe there's also an element of Racing Point putting maybe a little bit too much focus on a wet setup for qualifying and not getting it right for the race. It's tricky because Racing Point are one of those teams that don't grant us an audience after the race via Zoom or Teams. So we sort of have to rely on what they put out and the slightly, unfortunately, soft questions that are put to them in the pen.
Indeed. Well, just before we talk about Stroll and Racing Point and obviously Perez's podium, Luke, let's talk about Valtteri Bottas. As I said, six spins on the day, terrible result. He's lost the championship and he just never got going. He looked great off the line, and I think maybe if he'd just been able to keep a little bit more to the outside, he might have got round Ocon, but not a lot he could do when Ocon went round. You and I went to his Zoom press conference that was slightly farcical after it ended after. the first question was a bit bizarre from one of the journalists. And then it ended after 4 minutes when Lewis Hamilton had apparently arrived and they were going to take a group photo. So Valtteri Bottas was taken away from us, very sadly. But, you know, such is the team's want. Anyway, back to Bottas. You know, how does he bounce back from this? Because he's lost another championship in, this time in devastating circumstances.
Yeah, it was a pretty disastrous race. And as you say, we sort of logged on for that Zoom call and it was announced very last minute. So you and I were sort of two of the only journalists there. And there was a local journalist in there who hasn't appeared at all this season and put their hand up first to ask a question. And I think was trying to ask Valtteri Bottas, what's it like to win a race? Like for, I don't know.
It didn't make any sense considering he finished 14th. It didn't. But anyway.
and after that of all races, and Bottas like was obviously in a very sort of very somber mood, let's say. So of all the questions to ask, that's probably the wrong one.
Although very quickly, look, I did think he was very polite with that journalist and was just like, sorry, yes, what do you mean? Can you just sort of clarify? He wasn't, because he could have easily had a temper tantrum about that.
No.
But I really respected him for how he responded to that question. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Absolutely. but to be fair, like even when we were asking about his disastrous race, his words, he was very good at explaining it, and he said that basically the first 200 meters were fantastic, like made a really good start, and then it just all went downhill, that he had to spin his car to avoid Ocon, and then had the clash with Ocon again on the first lap at turn 9. And he said that when he had the car in a straight line, the steering wheel was going a little bit to the left. And that was obviously a clear sign of a problem with the car. And he said that the car just didn't feel right for the rest of the race. So as you said in the intro, that led to another 4 spins, so 6 in total. And yeah, he was just very, very open about it. He said that he was probably too eager in the move on Ocon at turn 9, but then otherwise just really, really struggled because the car was limping home, basically. We heard him come over the radio towards the end of the race. Ricky, his race engineer, said, "Oh, you've got 4 laps to go." Bottas, like, "I wish it was over. Like, I just want it done with." And he, but he said, like, now he's got the final 3 races with no pressure, basically, because the title race is completely settled. There's nothing to play for. He's looking set to finish 2nd in the standings ahead of Max Verstappen, so not a huge amount to play for there. So he can really just sort of try and relax. And he said he's interested to see how that lack of pressure sort of changes things for him. And I think we obviously famously saw that with Nico Rosberg at the end of 2015, when Hamilton had the title sewn up and had a rather enjoyable sort of end to his year. And that gave Rosberg a chance to build up some momentum that carried basically into the start of 2016 and ultimately helped set up his title victory. So I'm not saying a similar thing will happen, because Hamilton has obviously learned a lot since then. But I think it'll just be nice to see how Bottas can cope without any pressure, without the questions of, oh, like, what do you think about the title race and everything like that, because that's all to one side now. And I think for him, it's just about enjoying these final 3 races, doing what he can to just build up some momentum to take into the winter, and then after that spend another sort of off season trying to plot how on earth to beat Lewis Hamilton.
Absolutely. So you could almost think about it as the next 3 races is the start of 2021, because he needs to build up that momentum. Whereas Hamilton probably learned from 2015 and is just like, right, I'm not going to give you anything. No hope basically going into the winter, just to continue it for next year. Go on, Cotters.
Are we going to be looking at Valtteri Bottas 1.2.3? Are we on version 3.2.4 yet?
I think it was 3.0 this year, so I think that the next 3 races will be the beta version of Valtteri Bottas 4.0, maybe.
I am so tired of that reference. So none of you are allowed to ask him if it's going to be Valtteri 4.0 at the start of next season. Sorry.
Well, it depends. If they carry on calling press conferences at 2 minutes' notice, then there's not going to be many people in them. So, yeah. But Mercedes breaking the Red Bull record for shortest interval between announcement of press conference happening and start.
At least Mercedes do a press conference, though.
Yes.
Zing. Sassy. There we go. I like it. John, let's go back to Lance Stroll. How do you rate his weekend performance? Because he didn't really do a lot wrong, but I think you agree with the suggestion Cotter's made earlier about the fact that if he'd been a bit kinder on his tyres coming out of the pits, perhaps things would have been a bit different.
Yes, yeah, it's a classic Stroll weekend, that he's such an enigma as a driver that he gets lambasted like anything, because his dad owns a team and there's this perception he's only in Formula One because he's a paid driver and doesn't deserve his spot, blah blah blah. But you know, he's won championships in junior categories coming up, no matter, you know, certain benefits he has had on there. And on weekends and days where driving talent matters, where there's super low grip, you think of Monza that year in the Williams when he qualified on I think he qualified 3rd but moved up to 2nd because someone had a grid penalty. And Saturday, in qualifying here, when any driver could have been some sensational performance and needed to nail it in very tricky circumstances with a low grip track, really unpredictable, and you had to deliver it spot on, and he did it. You know, sensational performance yesterday to grab pole position. He said it was going to be a tough ask to win the race today, but he did the difficult bit. He got away well on the first lap. He built up that lead. And probably anyone in his circumstance would have done. If the track had dried out quicker and he went to slicks, he would have had a comfortable advantage at the front. So he was probably in that unfortunate situation of, you know, the race didn't play out in a way that it was so predictable that early advantage helped him at all, really. That track didn't dry enough. It was that crossover point between new inters and old inters rather than being a step into the slick tyre. And sure, he may have pushed too hard, but you know, you can replay that race 5 times and the track dries quicker. And you could say, oh, Stroll did the right thing in opening up a 6-second advantage at the start, because that was the key to him winning the race. So I don't think you can fault him for what happened today. And it was probably his strongest overall weekend, despite the, you know, you can nitpick that he pushed too hard on those inters after the pits. He could maybe have defended a little bit better as he fell back. But I think ultimately, considering how bad his previous five races have been, it was a pretty good weekend, I think.
Perhaps if he'd been advised not to push too hard, there'd have been another China in your hands reference, Johnny.
Yes. Well, what about the other...
This is not a useful interjection.
Never is, God, is it? Never is.
No.
What about the other Racing Point driver leak? What about Sergio Perez today? Because it was another good performance from Perez. And the key for him for staying second was that he didn't take the inters. The second set of inters. But yet it still nearly cost him at the end. And he said in the press conference, maybe with hindsight, would have been a little bit better to come in and get some fresh tyres. But yeah, what did you think of Perez today?
Yeah, a really impressive drive. I think that he made a very good start and was able to get into that second position well. And we sort of saw, as John said, like the Racing Points really pull this massive gap. And then when he came under pressure from Verstappen, he made a little mistake coming through turn 9 and 10. Obviously, then Verstappen tried to move and had his spin. And Perez, he was just very good at managing his tyres, basically. Again, like he is the tyre whisperer, as I think I said on yesterday's podcast. And he was able to sort of really get through that intermediate stint well. I think, 48 laps, I think he did on that set of tyres. And he said that he feared that if he'd done one more lap, they would have exploded, which maybe was a little bit dramatic. But he was definitely concerned about it. And we did see his pace really sort of plummet towards the end, which allowed Charles Leclerc and Sebastian Vettel to close up as they did in the final couple of corners. But he managed to hold on to get a second place, and it's long overdue. I mean, Perez said after Imola he was so frustrated that he missed out on that podium. He said that's the second time this year we should have got a podium and we haven't, but finally he's got that rostrum that he really, really deserves. And he's just been brilliant for Racing Point this season. He's now fourth in the Drivers' Championship, and if he can hang on to that, that's a massive, massive achievement. He's been basically single-handedly carrying Racing Point in the race for third place in the Constructors over the past sort of five races or so. And yeah, I think as much as this weekend we will remember for his teammates' escapades, getting pole position and leading so much of the race, I think Perez deserves a huge amount of credit for his performance, because he really, really did well. And yeah, I think that it's again sort of adding to the case of like, how on earth does he not get a place on the grid for next season when he can put in a performance like that and potentially finish fourth in the standings? Because yeah, he was brilliant, and I think that second place, like, it's a huge, huge result for him and for the team. Really deserves just all the credit in the world for getting it home and having sort of only a couple of minor errors, as we saw sort of with Verstappen and towards the end when he allowed the Ferraris to close again through 9 and 10. But otherwise, it was a fairly sort of spotless display from him.
It was. I know that we've chatted about this before, Luke. I do disagree with you ever so slightly about his overall season performance. I think he has underperformed at some very key moments. Think about Austria losing the wing that cost him the podium and things like that. But not taking away from the fact that he has been brilliant of late, and especially this weekend. But John, Luke touched on an important point there about Perez and his future. Do you think that finishing second and starting second and being overall very, very good on the weekend, do you think that has any impact on what happens next in terms of Perez's future?
I still think that Perez's future all rests on what Alex Albon can do. I think Red Bull would like nothing more than Albon to deliver what they want, which is get close enough to Verstappen to become rear gunner. If he beats Verstappen, that's brilliant. But I don't think they expect him to beat Verstappen. They want him to qualify within two or three temps, shadow him home, and just become a second car that can disrupt the Mercedes as they go forwards. And there was a phase of the race today, it looked like Alex was going to win as the Racing Points fell back and Max had taken him out the picture. Alex was there. He'd pulled off that great move past Seb Vettel. You thought he was going to get past Perez quite quickly and move on up. And then it all went wrong again. The inters went off, he dropped back on pace, had the spin pitted, and then fell back again. So I think the Perez decision will all rest on Alex and what he can do in these next three races. And he needs, if he can take the bits of this weekend where he was strong and was good enough and do that repeatedly for three races, then I think he's got quite a good chance of keeping that seat. But he can't afford more spins, and he can't afford to fall further away from Max, especially in qualifying.
And I do wonder how many more opportunities he's going to get to stake a claim to that seat. And we hear Christine Horner keep saying, look, we want Alex to really claim it and prove why that seat is his and why he should be there. And as you said, John, today was that was the perfect opportunity to do it. He was in contention for a podium at minimum, potentially even a race win. And it just all fell away from him again. And it's so frustrating to see him get sort of so close yet so far. And then just when the result appears to be on the cusp of coming, it's just not that, like he loses it and misses out, and it's a real big shame, because I think today if he'd have got a podium, if he'd have won the race, then I think Red Bull could have gone, right, that's all we need, we can go ahead and push on with you. But the fact again he didn't, and to make matters worse, the man who could replace him next season, Sergio Perez, was so good today and did get on the podium. I think that's not going to help his case at all. And he's running out of opportunities. Red Bull initially said, I think before Portimao, they wanted to sort of give him two races to see what he'd do and then think about it. Portimao and Imola didn't go well. And then Horner was again asked earlier this week, what are you thinking? And he said, well, we'll give him more time. Like, the market's pretty set. So we've been bought time basically to delay a decision potentially until after Abu Dhabi. But now Albon's still only got three more chances. Like, he's got three more races to say to Red Bull, this is why you should hire me for next season. And he can't afford to let more opportunities like we saw today pass by.
Well, I think his saving grace today, though, is that Max also had a bit of a shocker that, you know, in the early phase, Max looked like he was the one who was going to come through. I mean, pre-race, you thought either Max Verstappen is going to absolutely dominate this, or we're going to have a strange winner, because Max had been brilliant in practice, had been brilliant through most of qualifying before it didn't work on that final run of the Inters. You thought he's going to dive inside at turn one and will disappear, and this will be a 1 minute victory to Max Verstappen. He'll be sensational, but the start was terrible. Fell back into the pack. He came back. He got too impatient, I think, trying to get past Perez. There's no point being that close through that turn. Spun and then dropped back into the pack. He spun later on as well. Didn't feel comfortable with that car. So I think there are, when you mitigate how Alex's race was compared with Max, it wasn't a complete disaster. So I think that's the only saving grace for Alex today. It wasn't as if Max had won and Alex had this chance to finish second and fell back. I think the Red Bull car today was tricky, and it may be related to the Honda engine mapping, because that start today was, it looked as though they'd failed to get away at all, really. They just seemed to be stationary as everyone else came powering past them.
Yeah, this, I suppose, to be fair to Alex, this race is very much an outlier, isn't it? Because it was a Grand Prix in which many aspects were counterintuitive. You know, very, very often the tyre wear is, or tyre operations are relatively linear. You know, your tyres degrade or wear out, you put new ones on, you go faster. This was a race where bolting on a new set of tyres wasn't necessarily your magic ticket to success. And it was a race where experience told, didn't it? And cool heads prevailed. People who knew how to work their tyres, how to manage them, how to, you know, bring them up to temperature gradually. And you saw that with the way Lewis won, with the way Sergio Perez played it. And compare and contrast very much, as Johnny said, with Max, who... The red mist came down as soon as his car went into anti-stall at the start. He just sort of lost it, didn't he? He looked ragged. He sounded ragged when he was on the radio. He just sounded like someone who was flapping. And the people who flapped in today's race failed. The people who kept their heads succeeded.
Was today the most experienced podium of the season in terms of total races of everyone on there?
Yeah.
I mean, I thought so. Definitely the most world titles. 11. But although they got the flags wrong, Sebastian, yes. Sebastian Vettel is not Mexican.
Right? No, that was the F1 struggle of the day.
Connors, do you have a point to make, an observation perhaps, about Sergio Perez before we move on to Ferrari?
Yeah, I thought it was a good race for him. When he was another of these people who talked about what might have been afterwards, and I was surprised and a little bit disappointed when he said that maybe he should have come in for new tyres, and that was clearly not the right thing to do. He managed to, was it lap 10? He came in for Inters, and then he made those tyres last for the rest of the race, and that was his magic ticket, and he made very few errors. I'm fascinated to see how the Autosport driver rankings play out for this race, because I think there might be some unexpected results.
Are there any 10s, though?
There is one 10.
Ooh. There's one.
And
ten.
I've had to use my power because I write them.
Your power?
To over, yeah, no, the,
power? The little, are you He-Man and the Masters of the Universe?
I have no idea what that means, so quite possibly.
I got that.
That says more about you than you, disappointingly.
I'm using
not a good one. One with ridiculous hair. I'm using, yeah, because basically I have, what's the word? A discretion to override what I like. And I'm doing it in the case of Lewis Hamilton. So there we go.
To answer your question properly, he did struggle in qualifying.
So you could make the argument that overall on the weekend you didn't maximise it, but that race driver was just so brilliant. That's why he's going to get that.
I think it's quite meritorious. But yeah, to answer your question properly, I think the Perez's race was very much defined by that opening stint where it looked like Lance was heading off into the distance, and it looked like Perez was very much under pressure. But for by and large, apart from his little slip up at turn nine that, you know, sort of nearly enabled Verstappen to pass him, if Max hadn't spun it immediately afterwards, he was pretty much holding it together. So it was a very, very mature race. But, you know, as you said, he has arguably underperformed earlier on this season. So in the balance of things, it's tricky. So, like I said, I look forward to seeing the ratings.
Good. No one else does. No, I'm joking. So least of
the
all me.
The denizens anyway. Of the internet don't. Oh, actually, they do because they want to get angry.
The boring cowards that don't use their real names. Yes, tiresome. Yes, let's just one more very quick point before we move on to Ferrari. Perez obviously used his inters. They were brand new when he put them on, whereas, like I said, Hamilton's were old. Yeah, it really demonstrates again how good Hamilton is when it comes to the tyres, because he made an older set last even better than Perez, because Hamilton didn't give up at the end, whereas Perez's did. Although I think it's really interesting that they both referenced being worried about them exploding, particularly Lewis Hamilton, I think, because he said this at other races, that when he gets a vibration, suddenly he's wondering, are the tyres going to explode? I think what happened at the last lap of the British Grand Prix has really stayed with him, and he doesn't want anything like that to happen again, quite understandably. Well, Luke, let's come on to Ferrari and Sebastian Vettel. I think this is maybe the first time on the podcast this season we're going to talk about a really excellent performance from him today. Okay, yeah, underperforming in qualifying. He said that was simply, did he underperform? You know, basically his point was less water on the track today made it easier for Ferrari. So perhaps yesterday that was just as good as it got for Ferrari, and he was the lead driver because he beat Leclerc. But yeah, how good was Sebastian Vettel today? Because he suddenly was up there amongst the leaders, having been way back in the pack on the grid.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I think we saw shades of the old Vettel. It was quite nice. His first podium finish in over a year. And he made an excellent start to get up to, I believe he was fourth in the opening stages. And then had Lewis Hamilton really stuck behind him for a long time. And Hamilton was complaining, so I just can't find a way past. And earlier in the weekend, a picture of Hamilton with a Ferrari had been tweeted, and Mercedes did a joke sort of reply to it saying, oh, well, there's always a Ferrari behind Lewis, and that in the race then came back up again. And a friend of mine's the admin for that account, and he was just like, yeah, I shouldn't have tweeted that. It's just not come back well. But it was, and that was really funny. And then, but that really spoke to how well Vettel was doing. That for all of the sort of Spinala memes and saying that he can't handle pressure and things like that, today he didn't put a foot wrong. Like, he was really in a good groove. And I think that the tyres sort of went through these different phases, and he was losing a lot of time sort of in the early part of that intermediate tyre stint. But then as the sort of it wore down and wore on, he found more and more time and was able to really like get close to the front runners. So it was a really excellent drive. And then, yeah, coming to those closing stages, he was running fifth, just behind Perez and Leclerc. And coming into the closing stages, he was running fourth, just behind Perez and Leclerc. And then obviously Perez made the mistake. Leclerc tried the overtake, but then ran wide, and Vettel was able to nab that position really, really well. And across the line for third place. And yeah, a really good drive. And he said afterwards, like, oh, well, if we'd gone for slicks, maybe we could have gone for a race win. But obviously there was the threat of rain. Vettel was told on the radio heavy rain might be coming on the last lap, so it'd have been a big risk to take. But I think it was a real like mistake-free race. Like, when so many other drivers were making errors and spinning, Vettel, the one driver who's got so much stick this year for making errors, for not being able to handle pressure, he just took it all in his stride. So I think deserves a huge amount of credit for that.
He certainly does. But yeah, he was saying about being stuck behind Vettel, he was like, I was thinking at one point, oh, Sebastian's had a really tough year and he's driving really well, and seemed to be like, oh, I was actually sort of cheering him on. Then he just goes, but really I was thinking, damn it, get out of my way, or something like that, or I want to get past. I just thought it was very funny about that. And it's interesting, Cotters, that those two, obviously a couple of years ago when they were fighting for world titles, it was like, right, who's going to be the first driver to get five since Schumacher? Who's going to carry on, keep going? And Vettel seems to have gone down and Hamilton seems to have carried on going up. But there's clearly a lot of respect between the two of them. I think you've seen that quite a lot this season, particularly with Vettel's support for Hamilton's action on racial equality. And I have to say, I thought his helmet this weekend, Sebastian Vettel, with the rainbow and everything, and absolutely wonderful. And I think he's doing a really good job, just also just being himself, you know, which I think is really good. But yeah, what did you make of the sort of little moment they had in Parc Fermé, where Hamilton was basically just getting a grip of himself, just wanting to be composed as he got out of the cockpit, and Vettel sort of put his arm in and was just like, we're witnessing you make history here.
I thought that was very generous, very sporting of him. And very often we look at what Sebastian Vettel does, and he can at times be a little bit not very grown up, but at other times he can. And yeah, you're right, 2 or 3 years ago we were talking about the Vettel versus Hamilton as a real rivalry for the ages, and who would be first to the five world championships. And you know, the Ferrari thing hasn't panned out for Vettel. It gives me some hope that, you know, the fire's still burning there, and that maybe at Racing Point Aston Martin next year, Seb will be able to pull off something special, maybe. Who knows? It's tricky to tell because we don't really know, but he'll have been heartened by the performance of the pink Mercedes today, certainly, won't he? And but I think, you know, to come back to my previous point, this was a race where experience told out, and he sort of strung it together very, very well. He was patient when he needed to be. I was very surprised to see him move away from Lewis sort of towards the end of that first phase. And it was difficult to work out, because I'd forgotten to switch my iPad on and get the live timing up, whether it was him speeding up or Lewis slowing down. So there was a little bit in the Codling household of fiddling with the mechanisms to get the timing up. But it was very, very impressive. And also, he failed to hit his teammate, which is something that can't be said of the past couple of seasons.
Indeed. And John, actually, I wanted to bring in Leclerc here, because actually, when they started the last lap of the race, Vettel wasn't going to get on the podium. It was Leclerc in third. And then he comes across Perez, who, like I said, struggling, goes off at turn nine. That's what gives him the opportunity to get by. A damning indictment of the state of Ferrari's engine, that Leclerc had DRS and Perez was still able to run off the track on the wets and then almost get back alongside him, which is why I think Leclerc outbreaks himself. But how good was he? Because bearing in mind, I said he was 14th in the lap one because qualifying hadn't gone very well, and he kept being the one to pull the trigger and change the fresh inters. How good was he through the race to even get himself into contention for the podium?
But it's classic Leclerc though, isn't it? We saw it, if you go back to the first race of the season, when Ferrari's struggles were fairly clear to see. That an under the radar qualifying, didn't expect to see them do anything in the race, and then suddenly, bang, in that closing stages, he was up there and grabbed a podium finish. And we saw it at Silverstone as well. He's very much that long game player, that you know, plotting that race, staying out of trouble, coming through and delivering. And after the race, he was utterly furious with himself. There's some team radio.
It was excellent swearing. You know, I'm a fan of swearing.
Brilliant swearing in English, brilliant swearing in Italian. He was claiming it was a worse mistake, feels stupider than he did at Baku when he crashed into the barriers in qualifying that year. So I think he was frustrated, but equally, you know, it's a weekend where both Ferraris pretty evenly matched in pace terms, probably a combination of the track surface. Actually, cars couldn't produce the full speed they were capable of. So it wasn't as if it was high grip surface and you're on downforce and efficiency. And a weekend where driving talent probably played a little bit more of a role than it would normally. And Seb, the bits of the car and the car's handling that he doesn't like and he can't feel in qualifying and he can't feel in the race weren't there. It was about understanding the balance between the tyres, understanding the grip, managing the tyres. And that's where his experience paid off.
Another feather in Vettel's cap there is sometimes your experience tells you when to hang back because the two people dueling in front of you are about to have a shunt. And I've been rummaging through my box of memories for a quote. I think it was Jody Scheckter.
Your box of memories, that's called your brain. Yeah. Cutters.
Yeah, I've had to send someone down with a torch and rummage through the dusty things. It's a little bit like, you know, that final shot from Raiders of the Lost Ark where you see them pushing the crate that contains the Ark of the Covenant into a little dusty corner, and the camera pans back and there's tens of millions of other crates. You know, I'm afraid that's my brain, and most of those crates are filled with absolute nonsense. But
we know.
I dread to think of a room full of Codders' memories and thoughts. That would be the worst nightmare possible.
But the point which I'm laboriously reaching is that I've heard more than once a driver after a race that's had a successful outcome for them from a disadvantageous position. I was watching these two guys dueling in front of me, and I knew that they were going to hit each other or have an accident or something was going to go wrong. So I just didn't get involved, and I waited. I backed myself to be in the right position when the inevitable happened. And this was what happened on that last lap. Vettel just sort of waited, seized the moment, as it were, as one of our colleagues in the press room might have had it on his Tinder profile, and he seized the moment and benefited
and reverted back to a podium position.
Asked as to whether to the podium had eventuated.
Now we're all on the same page. Okay, right. And yeah, anyway, moving swiftly on from what they're getting at. Luke, do you think that Leclerc, who is famously very self-critical, do you think he was being a little bit hard on himself at the end of the race? He was bashing the steering wheel, as John said, swearing in all these different languages, to the point where his engineer had to very calmly say, "And radio off." I thought it was quite amusing.
Yeah, it was, as you say, that is just a hallmark of Charles Leclerc. He's always so, so hard on himself. And I think even, what was it, Bahrain 2018, his second race, when he spun in Q2 and he was on the road like, I'm so stupid, and came out again with that quote, as John said, sort of in Baku in last year when he crashed in Q2. And he's just very, very hard on himself, like, and it's not really warranted. Like, ultimately these mistakes do happen, and he went to try and get second place. Like, he went for the position, and it's better than just sort of hanging back and sort of thinking, well, I'm just gonna just accept third. So he has to go for it. And this season, that's not going to cost him a championship. Like, it's not going to be a make or break for his season. It would have been nice to get a third podium of the year. Frankly, it's two more already than Ferrari arguably deserve or should have got. But that, again, speaks to how well he's performed this season. And yeah, I thought his performance today was fantastic. And it was a shame that he did sort of throw away that podium on the last lap when he went for that move. But I think it's better to have gone for it than not to have. So yeah, massively too hard on himself, but I think that's just how Charles deals with things, really. He is very, very self-critical, and I think that we're gonna hear that, I think, until he sort of gets a little bit older and grows up a little bit. And I don't mean that in a slight on Charles at all, because he's a very, very mature young man. But ultimately, when you're 22 or 23 years old, like, you don't have the emotional maturity that a driver of like Lewis Hamilton or Sebastian Vettel's age would have. So that'll come in time, basically. But I think that he can be still very pleased with his performance today. And I think that just on the red mist to the final lap, when you see yourself drop from potentially finishing second to coming fourth, you're obviously going to be very frustrated.
Absolutely, indeed. Just before we move on to the next topic, I was amused by Sebastian Vettel's, it was a clear joke in the press conference about that Ferrari getting their massive points haul on the one weekend where Mattia Binotto has decided to watch the race from back in the factory. Probably a joke you can make a little bit easier when you're leaving the team at the end of the year, but nevertheless, amusing from Vettel. Another driver scored a very good result, fifth place for Carlos Sainz, having risen up from, you know, well down the field on the grid. For McLaren, Codders, how did he do it? Because it was a fairly unseen rise.
Yeah, I think they stopped at the right time, but also they'd investigated some sort of changes they could make to the settings in the car and Carlos's approach to tyre warm-up overnight. And Carlos spoke about how they'd stayed up quite late, him and his engineers, working out how they might do this by adjusting settings, by him driving a little bit differently and experimenting on the laps to the grid. So And he said he could feel those improvements in tyre warm-up even then. So I think that set him up for the race. And there was something else that Andreas Seidel said in the press conference, which was that it's all about not being the hero on lap one. So the McLarens had varied fortunes on the first lap. Lando had the world's worst start. But just sort of playing yourself in, having a productive relationship with the rest of the team, and just taking the benefits when you can. So you saw when the Alfa Romeo went wide, Carlos took advantage. He just sort of played himself in very, very gradually, and crucially, when he made the stop for tyres, pretty much at the same time as Stroll did, he didn't go out too aggressively. He had, you know, his first couple of laps out of the pits were gentle. He treated his tyres properly. He was in constant dialogue with his engineers about whether he was doing the right thing, and the car came alive under him because he got the tyres into the window, and that was basically how Carlos did what he did. It was a masterclass in tyre management. I know though that, you know, when we talk about Grand Prix being masterclasses in tyre management, we're usually talking about boring races, but actually tyre management was a critical facet of anyone's success.
It clearly was, as what happened with Hamilton and Perez. Hamilton able to keep his tyres alive to the end, go on, Luke.
Yeah, and also massive for McLaren, the results today, to ensure that the fight for third place in the Constructors' Championship is still alive. Andreas Seidel was quite concerned after qualifying on Saturday, saying that this is a real chance for Racing Point to basically snatch all the points they need to, like, kill that race completely. And there was only a point separating Racing Point, Renault and McLaren going into the race weekend. But because McLaren came away with a really good double score, even with Perez getting on the podium, they're only 5 points behind Racing Point. So they've not lost a lot of ground at all. Renault only picked up a single point, so really dropped back, and now probably have to be more worried about Ferrari catching them than the two teams ahead of them. So, yeah, I think McLaren, they can be really proud of the result and the performance they put in today as a team, and to ensure that sort of fight for P3 is staying alive, which, given in the opening stages, they saw their direct rival running 1-2 and sort of 15 seconds clear of the field, it must have been really sweating that could have killed their hopes completely.
Absolutely, and really of the three teams involved in that P3 scrap for the constructors championship, it's Renault that's come away worse. They came into the weekend in third, they're now fifth, and at one point they were looking like they were going to be the ones chasing after Racing Point until the first corner, when Ricciardo unfortunately taps Ocon around. But yeah, John, what happened to Renault for the rest of the race, and how did Ocon in particular react to his misfortunes on the first lap?
Yeah, so I spoke to Esteban tonight. He looked at the video again and felt, you know, it's just unfortunate circumstance of Lewis down the inside of Daniel. Daniel had to straighten the steering out a bit to avoid a collision, and that tagged Esteban. Esteban reckons he probably would have left the first corner in third place if things had played out without a collision, and wouldn't have been able to hold it on to the end, he reckons, but could have got fifth or sixth place. Daniel, on the other hand, just said never at any point of that race did he feel he was on top of the tyres or the pace was there. He said his engineer would come on the radio at times and say, "You're the fastest car on the track." And then two laps later, the tyres would be falling off and the pace had disappeared. So just wasn't a weekend where it really worked very well for Renault. Daniel now says they're the dark horse for third place. They're a bit behind, but neither driver's downbeat about it. They said if there were two races left, they'd be quite concerned, but they think, you know, three races coming up, warmer temperatures suit their car a bit better. We've got that low downforce Bahrain outer loop track, chaotic outer loop track perhaps, coming up. So the fight for the third's not done yet, but they definitely need to not have any repeat problems in these final three races.
Yeah, you get the feeling that outer loop race in particular will favour Renault, considering how fast they've been at like Spa and Monza in the past, well, this year as well. Let's dip to the back of the field now, Luke, and talk about Williams. As John said, Dave Robson had referenced on Saturday, he didn't know whether it was going to be a tortoise or a hare race strategy. He was talking about it potentially being dry, and it did make me think about all that work I did on Friday to analyse the dry running pace, and then it was completely wet for the rest of the weekend. But such is the life of an Autosport Grand Prix editor, and I'm very, very lucky to be able to do it. It sort of was nearly over, certainly for George Russell, before the start of the race when he went off in the pit lane. Antonio Giovinazzi also crashed on the way to the grid in his Alfa Romeo, unfortunately just damaged his front wing. But what, just before I get eventually to my question, as I know I do ridiculously, there's an excellent amusing section on lap two between George Russell and Valtteri Bottas, where Bottas, first of all, they follow Nicholas Latifi at the end of lap one, and he just spins off completely on his own because the two Williams cars were on the intermediates in an incredibly bold call. I don't know whether that was hare, tortoise, or some other, you know, particularly confident animal. The thought that Inters on the very wet track were particularly appropriate. Anyway, Latifi spins off. Bottas gets ahead of Russell, but he goes off again, back onto the runoff at the end of turn one where he'd spun around at the start of the race. Russell follows him off in sympathy. And then they're sort of hovering. Bottas being like, is he going to come by? Russell being like, is he going to go ahead? Is he letting me by? And then he slips away. And at one point goes, oh, go on, Bottas. Like, after you. Yeah, I thought that was quite funny. But yeah, what happened to George Russell, first of all, in that pit lane? And what happened in his race after the amusing bit with Bottas there?
Yeah, he said there was just no grip whatsoever, that he was just really, really struggling. And it's something that he spoke about a lot in the press session following the race, that he said it was the grip and track conditions were just so poor that even going super, super slowly into that pit lane and tiptoeing around, that he just couldn't turn in, and obviously hit the wall, as you said. And he said that he knew it wouldn't be too much of an issue just because he was going that slowly, that there wasn't going to be any major damage, so they could always just get a new front wing sorted and that was okay. Williams always planned to start the cars from the pit lane because they wanted to keep the tyres in the tyre blankets and not have the same issue of the cars doing that formation up and then being sat on the grid for a little while. So that was always the plan for them. And then his race, he said it was just another case of tyre temperatures, that it just swung dramatically and you could lose sort of 2 or 3 seconds a lap if your tyres weren't in the right window. And ultimately the race sort of just faded away from him in the end and wound up in 16th. And he just lamented the absolute lack of grip throughout the weekend. And it's something that has created a real spectacle for everybody today. And I think we've all enjoyed a very entertaining Grand Prix. But George was very, very vocal. He said it's not Formula One. He said that ultimately you want to see the best drivers in the world with the best cars in the world and the best circuits pushing to the limit, even in the wet. And he said that you just didn't get any of that today because the grip levels were so unpredictable due to the resurfacing. And he was really quite upset about it. And I think that is something that is gonna, I think, polarize opinion, particularly among fans, whether you enjoy the race because there was no grip whatsoever and you sort of saw the drivers really having to find the limit and use all of their skills, or do you want to see them being able to basically push to their own limit and actually have a circuit that is grippy enough that they don't sort of have to sort of feel their way around and be sort of guessing a lot of the time. And George called it a lottery, and he was very, very disappointed, like, just how that went. So I think that, yeah, it just, but it's another opportunity, it's another sort of crazy race that Williams haven't ultimately capitalized on. I think that when we saw them start on Inters, we thought, oh, okay, we'll try something a bit different here, it could work out. And Russell did get up to sort of that magic 11th place that he seems to flirt with so often this season at one stage. But as the race sort of faded, as the race wore on, his hopes really faded, and another chance missed, really.
It's very easy, isn't it, after a race like this that's been made interesting and unpredictable by circumstances being unusual, to say, let's make everyone like this. But I think that's going down the wrong way, because let's face it, we have spent the past 10 years living with the legacy of a decision made in the aftermath of a race like this by Bernie Ecclestone, to say every race should be like this. Let's insist that the incoming tyre supplier has tyres that are sensitive and fall off a cliff and are unpredictable, and then it'll make for brilliant racing. And what we've had is some great races, but also an awful lot of drivers complaining that the tyres are too sensitive, an awful lot of races that have been slower than they could have been because people are having to babysit their tyres so to avoid making too many pit stops. So yeah, I would avoid at all costs the mentality of saying that's great, let's have everyone like that, because it's a dead end, really.
Yeah, and I also think that the circuits that are not owned, sort of state-owned, are going to be bristling at the suggestion they'll have to resurface and do low grip because the amount of money that it would cost them. And then Lewis Hamilton to turn around at every track and say it's shit with a capital S, which is a great turn of phrase, but I'm sure they wouldn't appreciate that after having invested so much. But anyway, let's actually come back to Hamilton. John, he mentioned, or we talked about earlier, you know, what's he going to do over the next three races? He wants to win them all. He suggested that. perhaps learning the lessons of 2015, when maybe he gave Nico Rosberg, or, you know, probably it's generally considered that he did give him a bit of momentum coming into his title winning year. But also the other really interesting element for these last three races is that Lewis Hamilton does not have a contract. Currently, he won't be on the grid in 2021, although it's generally accepted that he will be. He said sort of in the press conference, you know, we're in the Middle East for 3 weeks, potentially everyone shut in hotel rooms. That's definitely what's going to happen for the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix. There's a sort of a biosphere being created where everyone's locked on Yas Island, hopefully allowed to interact away, you know, or at least leave isolation in your rooms or whatever, but certainly there's going to be no going out into the city or whatever. Is that the opportunity that he's going to take with Toto Wolff to do his contract? And if so, why have they waited until now?
Because I think there were Toto suggested tonight could wait till after the season, but I think he's right. The Middle East opportunity, the fact everyone's going to be away for 3 weeks and they will be hanging around in Bahrain for a little while, it basically needs Toto and Lewis to sit down around a table. They can sit either side of a table and it can be more than 2 metres long, so it should be fine just to do it. But I think they were also quite right. Toto's talked about, you know, it would have been foolish to have, you know, met up at Silverstone time, for example, thrashed out a contract. Toto gives Lewis the virus and it costs him the world championship because he's missed three races. So they've waited till the title's done. They can thrash out the details. And I'm sure it's going to happen. I'm sure he's going to stay. And his comments at the last race where he says, there's no guarantee I'll be here next year, based purely on the fact, until you have a contract, there is no guarantee. You have to do the deal. You have to get these things signed. You have to get it all done. But I think it's more likely than not it'll be done before the final race of the season. And I've got zero doubt that he will be racing at the first race of the season, wherever that first race is next year.
Yep, I agree with you there, John. Cotters, what did you make of Hamilton's reaction? You know, you heard it on the radio. He was clearly upset. He says afterwards, again, in the press conference, he burst into tears as soon as he crossed the line and he sort of wanted to compose himself. He made a joke about not wanting people to see him cry because he'd seen other Formula One drivers do that. And it'd just be suggesting that he didn't approve of that or whatever. But yeah, what did you make of how he reacted to making his history today?
Yeah, he's always been a driver who wears his heart on his sleeve. He's find it difficult to filter his emotions. And I'll tell you what, I thought I had something in my eye when I was watching his post-race interview. You know, was
it your box of memories?
I was rummaging around. It might have been the dust. It might have been a mote of dust in my eye from a dusty crate. But it was certainly very, very sort of almost a tearjerker moment, wasn't it? You know, all those emotions came flooding through him of his dreams when he was a kid and all those years living, you know, travelling around Europe with his dad, living out of a suitcase, going to rubbishy kart tracks and having to race with rubbish tyres because they didn't have the best of everything. And I think it really, really today brought home to him the scope and scale of his achievement, and maybe opened a window to him. Now he's reached that peak to see another peak in the distance, that of the eighth world championship. So, yeah, I think onwards and upwards. He's not going to walk away.
Indeed, and Luke, coming to you, where do you rank this particular title and what Hamilton has achieved this year? Because obviously, everyone's going to look at the headline. You know, seven world titles now, equal with Michael Schumacher. He's technically sort of nosing ahead because he's got more wins. If you wanted to consider the greatest in Formula One, I do urge you to buy Autosport's 70th anniversary special issue out on Thursday. Excellent magazine there, or bookazine, as we've got a podcast coming out where we derived that term. And although I quite like it, but anyway, there we go. I'm doing my usual thing.
It's getting better than Magook.
No idea what that is, but indeed, yes, it is. Luke, this year, this title, as I said, an amazing seventh title, but it's come during a pandemic and it's come in a season and a year that's very, very important to Lewis Hamilton because of the difference he has been able to make and the steps that he's taken in that all important. And we do emphasise that again, that tremendous and wonderful push, a needed push for racial equality and more diversity. Hamilton always talks about this. It's not just, you know, people of colour that he wants to see promoted in Formula One. He wants to see more women in there, you know, full stop, also in more positions of power. You know, it's obviously been a year that's been very dear to his heart. So where do you think that makes a difference to where we sort of rank this title compared to the other six?
Definitely, yeah. I think that if we go on purely sporting terms, I think you would argue, well, Mercedes are that far ahead of all the other teams, so Lewis only really had competition from Valtteri Bottas. How strong is Bottas as a title contender? Would he be stronger than Nico Rosberg when the two of them were together? I think back to sort of 2017, 2018, when Hamilton faced a very strong Ferrari and a very strong Sebastian Vettel. 2008, when he faced a very strong Ferrari with Felipe Massa. So I think that it's maybe hard to suggest that on a sporting level, this is the best of the lot. But I think it is by far the most significant of his championship wins. I think the fact that he has done it in, as you said, a year where you've got the pandemic, you've got around the world the push against racism, the push for racial equality, and that so much has gone on in this year that Lewis Hamilton has given so much energy to. And he said very early on that if he were to win the title this year, it would be the most important to him just because of everything going on around the world. And I think that to win it, not only to win it, but to win it with such an impressive display and so dominantly with three races to spare again in the 17 race season, I think it just speaks to how strong he has been this year and how good he's been this year. And I think, yeah, I think it's one that we will really remember because he's done it while still being a real spokesperson for the push against racism, to make the world a more equal place, for greater diversity, both in our sport and around the world. And I think that he has proven again why he is, to me, the greatest, I think, because of everything he does off track as well as on track. And I just think he deserves huge credit for that. And I think it's, yeah, a real amazing year. And I think that over the radio, he said after the race, he said, that's for all the kids out there who dream. And he said, you've got to basically have your dreams, but speak them into existence. And it's a story that goes back to when he was racing remote control go-karts with his dad and then stepped into karting. And all the way through his life, he's just always fought. And yeah, I think it's just really incredible to see what he's achieved. And I think this was the real peak of where he's got to, but as Connor said, it could go even higher.
I think one of the difficulties when you try and judge championships is the perception can sometimes be that if you have a really, really tough fight and take it to the final lap of the final 100 metres of the thing and then win the championship, that seems to be a hard-earned or better won championship than if you do what Lewis did this year, which was step up his game, perform brilliantly and dominate, leave no stone unturned, make zero mistakes. What he did this year can all too easily get viewed as he's had the best car, it looks easy because he's winning everything. So sometimes really, really hard to judge, and you can give credit for weakness sometimes when it comes to how you win success. You know, a victory where you have pulled out some brilliant performances, you've extracted everything from the car, you've pulled away by 2 seconds a lap out of sheer brilliance, can sometimes be viewed not as good as if you've messed about all the race, you've messed up the strategy, you've made 5 mistakes, but you somehow win on the final corner. So I think that's one of the factors we need to kind of look at when you put this season against other championships, you know, especially 2008, which are probably the one that everyone remembers because of that nature of that final corner with Timo Glock.
Indeed. Codders, we need to avoid the theory that I've obviously forgotten because I always do, but you referenced about once, you know,
peak end effect.
Peak end effect, there we go. I must write that down. I always forget. Anyway, sorry.
You should.
Go in.
Because let's face it, Lewis had a better season in 2007 than he did in 2008, competitively. And as Johnny says, it's very easy to rate a championship based on peak end effect and the excitement of it. And you have to counter by saying you've got to be a bit of a prat to have by far the best car in the field and to have the championship come down to the wire against anyone other than your own teammate, mentioning no names, Jacques Villeneuve. But if you make very heavy weather of a world championship with the best car, then I'd say you're not really fit to be in the pantheon.
Go on, do the impression.
What of Patrick Head?
Please.
Yes.
I love it.
I have to say that Jacques Villeneuve made very heavy weather of the 1997 World Championship.
Excellent, excellent. Well, on that note, we should bring things to a close. Thank you very much to the three of you for coming on the podcast tonight, and thanks for everybody listening along. Now, just before we go, we'd like to remind you that the latest issue of Autosport magazine came out on Thursday and is available on the supermarket shelves and in newsagents, as well as on the doormats of subscribers. And this week, as I said, look out for the Autosport 70th special bookazine, which is available on our website. There'll also be a new issue of the magazine for you to pick up every Thursday, packed full of news, analysis, and the usual stunning photography. And of course, if you want unlimited access to Autosport from the comfort of your home, visit autosport.com/plus to find out how to subscribe to our digital package. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Autosport Podcast.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.